Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I'm your chief investigator of images. So every week I'm joined by a lovely guest, knowledgeable guest, who brings one particular image to life with me. And today I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Professor Christiana Payne, who is Professor of Art History at Oxford Brookes University. And she has just written the most wonderful book. It's called Silent Witnesses, Trees in British Art, 1760 to 1870. And Christiana, we're in a beautiful place, aren't we? We're in Watts Gallery and Artists Village. And we're sat under an oak tree listening to birdsong, which is fitting, isn't it? So tell me a bit about what made you write this book.
Well, I've always been interested in landscape painting, and I wrote another book which was about painters on the coast. So I've been looking at themes, and indeed my research originally was on paintings of agricultural landscape. Mm. So I've kind of gone from one theme to another. And I started thinking about trees because I went to a Paul Sandby exhibition in Edinburgh. And in one room, there were these three or four enormous watercolours of beautiful beech trees. And I particularly like beech trees. And there was one, a special one I really liked, that showed this coppice of beech trees with all their roots interlinked.
Ooh.
And I thought that was wonderful. And it was very early, too. It was done in 1760. Mm. So quite early for that sort of naturalism. And I suppose that's what really appeals to me about painting. It's when you see something from the natural world and it's depicted in a way that it's convincing. Mm. I find purely abstract art a bit difficult to take. but at the same time, it's gone through the painter's imagination. And so it's not just a dull record of something. Mm. It's got something else as well. And
so beyond the photographic recording and the actual interpretation of nature. Yes
exactly. Yeah. And my favourite artists, I think, are John Constable and Samuel Palmer and the Pre-Raphaelites. Oh. And I thought, well, this is a project I can work on that will bring them all in, and Paul Sandby as well. So that's what I decided to do.
Well, I think it's absolutely inspired as a concept. And because, I mean, I'm obsessed with symbols, and so my PhD was on bird symbols. And I think trees are so ubiquitous, you know, that they're often overlooked. And yet their symbolism is so rich in so many instances. Mm. And actually, that brings us onto the painting that we're looking at. So do tell me what one we've got in front of us.
Right, well, this is a painting, a watercolour with gouache, and it's in the Ashmolean Museum, so it's one I've been able to go and see, because I live in Oxford, and it shows a beautiful young horse chestnut tree that is in flower, and underneath the horse chestnut tree, there is a figure, a shepherd or a shepherdess. It's very modern because it's sort of gender fluid, you can't quite tell which it is.
Yeah.
And nestling under the tree and leaning into the trunk and looking very comfortable, and around this shepherdess, I think she is. Mm. There are some beautiful sheep and lambs, again, all nestled together. And the whole scene just looks so comfortable and full of life. And it's a really beautiful image. And I particularly like this because Samuel Palmer was very fond of the horse chestnut tree. And most people thought horse chestnuts, especially in flower, were not picturesque and therefore shouldn't be painted.
Why was that? Because I would have thought when they're in flower, they're some of the most colourful of trees, aren't they?
Yes, we love them now, don't we?
Yeah.
They were thought to be excessive, I think. One of the things about the horse chestnut was it was supposed to be an example of conspicuous consumption. because it was often used in country houses, avenues, and it didn't. The fruits of the horse chestnut are not much good to us.
Oh, how interesting. So it was associated with sort of privilege and yes. wealth.
Yes, partly that. And also, I think Palmer liked it because you can outline each leaf and still produce something that looks naturalistic. And I did a lot of work on drawing manuals of the time, and most of the drawing manuals said you must never draw a tree showing each leaf separately. But because Samuel Palmer loved primitive art, he loved 15th century art, he wanted to work in that sort of primitive style. And so it really suited him perfectly.
So earlier manuals were saying you shouldn't show individual leaves. Why was that then?
Well, the manuals of Palmer's time.
Right. But yeah. it was because, what, you were supposed to give an impression of the tree?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But he was more interested in almost the scientific minutiae of depicting it.
Well, not scientific, no. Visionary, I guess, is the word, isn't it? Mm. So, yes, because what he was painting was a more perfect world than the world we live in, and therefore you can see things more clearly with the spiritual eye than you can with the physical eye. That was the idea.
That's beautiful. And Palmer himself, what do we know about him?
Ooh, well, yes. He was the son of a bookseller. He grew up in London, but in his 20s he moved to Shoreham in Kent and lived there. And his friends used to come and stay with him, and they used to go off walking in the countryside. Mm. And he painted moonlights with huge moons and sheep and flowering trees, and generally wanted to create this vision of a very bountiful countryside.
And who was he painting for then? Did he have wealthy patrons?
No, didn't sell much of his Shoreham work at all. Mm. Then in his 30s he went to Italy. He had a long honeymoon, nearly 2 years in Italy. And after that, he concentrated mostly on watercolour. Although there is one large oil painting that he did after that time, which is actually in the Ashmolean now.
Okay,
the Ashmolean has a fantastic collection of his work.
So, but in a way, he's sort of an unappreciated artist in some respects. Do you think that's because of his subject matter?
He was in his time. Mm. However, in the 1920s, he was there was an exhibition of his work at the V&A in 1926, and he was taken up in a big way by artists like John Piper and Graham Sutherland and the English Neo-Romantics. Mm. And since then, he's always been very popular. But I think his later work is underappreciated. Mm. Shoreham work, but people know about the Shoreham work, but not really about what he did later.
And this one in particular, then, it's 1831, and to you, does this express sort of his ideal, really?
Yes, I think so. And it's an ideal of several of the artists in this book, really, because what I've come to realise looking at trees and artists over the years I've been working on this is the mutually beneficial relationship between people and trees. Mm. And so I like the way that the shepherdess is sheltered by the tree. You know, it's as if the tree is actually looking after the shepherdess and the shepherdess is looking after the tree. And yeah.
And it's so beautifully composed, I think, because of the colour as well. And actually the way that the sheep are depicted, the way that their wool is done, it's not dissimilar to the way he's done the horse chestnut flowers, but then also this, what is this, a willow behind? What have we got behind there?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, it looks like some sort of flowering tree, doesn't it, from here? But on the other hand, it looks it's very elegant. It looks like an ash tree.
So, I mean, there's a pattern that's going through with these colours and these textures, aren't there?
Yes, it's very warm. And then there's a bit of blue to set off those warm gold colours. And then the sheep, well, they're sort of reddish as if they've been, you know, had the ruddle on them or whatever you call it. But there's quite a lot of red in the sheep.
And it's completely finished. This was the overall finished piece. Because, again, I love the fact that it's almost, you know, blocky and impressionist around the edges.
Yes, yeah. Bits of it do look quite unfinished.
But you think that's deliberate?
Yes, I think so. Mm. Yeah.
And why has he used this blue then? Because I can see the blue is very stark. Is this sort of a mountaintop that we're supposed to think up here? Or
I think there's the clouds.
Okay.
But they're quite pink, the clouds, aren't they?
So are
we supposed to think it's... I think it's the evening, probably. Because what he really loved was the twilight. So he thought that was a magical time.
Well, he does such beautiful moonscapes as well, doesn't he? I adore how he depicts the moon. I think he's one of the best.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about the time of day. That's interesting, isn't it? Because it is very pink, and it's very pink up there. So either it's early morning or it's early evening, and I don't know which. Maybe it's early morning. But on the other hand, the sheep are going to sleep.
Sheep are going to sleep. It looks like the sheep are going to sleep, and I do agree with you that it's probably a shepherdess because you have this flash of red that suggests sort of a headscarf, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But again, I love the fact that this almost looks like a river or a stream or a brook or something that could be coming through. But then it's the same blue.
It's the same blue
that he's used for her shirt,
and it's there as well. But yeah. I mean, there is a river running through Shoreham.
Well, so we might even have a kind of location here.
Yep.
But in returning to the chestnut tree itself then, because one of the things that comes out in your research, I suppose each tree has its own symbolism and its set of associations. Is that right?
Yes, different varieties of trees, absolutely. Mm. Yes.
So we talked about this being sort of associated with the wealthy, but does it have any other symbolism?
Not particularly, I don't think so. No, not in the same way that, say, the oak tree has a symbolism of longevity and the family tree and oaks for the navy and so on.
Yes. Yeah. So do you explore that in the book as
well?
Yes,
I do.
You do?
Yes, in the first chapter.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And so when you're talking about this idea of getting back to nature, which I presume is what Palmer's trying to do here, create a scene that is a pastoral idyll, is he citing ancient sources? And I'm thinking now sort of Arcadia and the Arcadian tradition.
Yes, yeah, he loved Virgil and he loved Milton too, actually. So, yes, he's very well read, Palmer. Mm. Being the son of a bookseller, he had access to books.
Of course. Yeah. So, because this is becoming quite fashionable as we go into the 18th, 19th century, isn't it?
Yes,
the idea of recreating Arcadia.
Yeah.
And it surprises me that he wasn't popular with the nobility as a result with his work.
Well, his work was seen as too extreme.
Oh.
Yes.
How?
One of the reviews he got was that he ought to exhibit himself with a sign round his neck.
Oh.
He was thought of as being so eccentric.
No.
Yes. Yes.
I can't see that. So is it because of what? What is it?
Well, this is less extreme, actually. It's the sepias in the Ashmolean from 1825, which have those very thick outlines. Do you know those?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
And that was just too radical.
Yeah, it was too radical. Yes, because it was so different from what other people were doing at the time.
That's amazing. And what do you think he was trying to capture with that, then? Because to me, it's almost photographic when he's playing with those textures. But why does he push against the boundaries so much, do you think?
Well, he has this meeting with William Blake, and that makes a huge impact on him.
I think meeting with William Blake's going to affect your mind.
It is, absolutely, yes.
So that's really interesting. So in a way, we're sort of seeing that impression of the romanticism of Blake coming through in the way he paints.
Yeah, and Palmer, as a young man, was very interested in the church, probably thought possibly about going into the church, as did Constable, actually.
Mm.
So both of them, when they do landscape painting, you know, it's kind of religious practice for them.
There's a spiritual element throughout. Yeah, definitely. That definitely is what comes out through this. It's almost like the chestnut tree is a divine protective hand, keeping the flock safe underneath, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you could read it as a biblical allegory almost. It's pushing it.
Yes. Except that it's very definitely set in Kent in the 19th century.
Well, I absolutely love it. And you've got another example that we were going to sort of compare it with from... So this is part of an exhibition, isn't it?
Well, as a result of doing the book, I went to the Higgins, Bedford, to see two of the drawings that I needed to see and started talking to the curator there, Victoria Partridge. And together we said, well, wouldn't it be nice to do an exhibition on this theme? And indeed, a year later, you know, that has actually happened. So this exhibition, which is called A Walk in the Woods, opened at the end of September and it goes on till the end of February. And... the Higgins Bedford are very keen on using the exhibition to get new audiences into the museum, and especially families and children. So I was there last week doing a day with children, which was great fun.
Aww.
And I had them all lying on the floor drawing trees.
Oh, fantastic!
And the way Victoria has set up the exhibition, it's very family friendly. It's a bit like going into the woods. She's got dark brown walls. The paintings are spotlit against those dark brown walls. She's got temporary walls in at angles in the exhibition so that you can walk round these angled walls as if you were walking through the woods.
Oh, I like that. And what are the big hits then that you've got in the exhibition?
The big hits. Well, what I went to see was a big drawing by Constable. It's one of his biggest drawings he ever did of two trees. Can we look at that?
Or yes, I'd love
ready?
To. No, I love, because Constable's heyway, and I was the sketches in the V&A, and I'm always struck by how rough his sketches
are.
Well,
I think people don't know him so much as a draftsman, but because he did these amazing portraits
of
trees.
Amazing.
Now, this is large. Let me see, what does it say? 73 centimetres high.
Good
so,
God.
So it's a big drawing, and in fact, he's done it on four different sheets of paper.
Yes, because
he obviously
see the drawings,
ran out.
Can't you?
You can see there, and there's another bit there too, and there's another bit here. and this is very definitely a portrait of two trees. This is a larch, dead straight, branches out horizontally like arms.
Yes.
And then the Scots pine, which is all twisting and twirling around. And I think of them as being like two dancers. You know, here's the male dancer, and he's just standing dead straight, supporting this female tree that is twirling around.
It is absolutely stunning. And and the reason I love it so much, and again, it does take me back to the Heywayne sketch, is when he sketches, when he does his draftsmanship, he's very, very careful, but some of the precision that you get in his paint isn't there in the sketching, and it becomes much bolder and almost more passionate.
Yes.
This is the real Constable to me.
Yeah.
I think he sort of distills it when he comes to add colour.
Mm.
this is so monochromatic and powerful, isn't
it? Yes, there's so much energy in that tree. And actually, I was in the National Gallery last week. I seem to get around a bit because I'm doing some lectures there later this month. And I was looking at Rubens's trees and thinking, you know, the way Rubens's trees curve around, they are like his figures. They're twisting and turning.
Mm.
And that gives them tremendous energy and movement. And obviously that's what he found in this tree as well, because it starts to twist right from the ground.
But why
it grows like that, I cannot imagine.
But the subtlety of this is that he's juxtaposed that with this absolutely bolt upright tree, which almost reminds me of when he did Salisbury Cathedral.
Yeah.
And you've got the sharp spire sticking up, and then the looseness of the foliage around it.
Yes.
So it's almost like the trees have taken the place of the art. I mean, it's almost Caspar David Friedrich stuff, isn't it, that the trees become the architecture.
Yes, and that's another artist who was interested in trees at this same time.
Who I adore. I think he's incredible. But so this is on in the exhibition, and it's a large piece. So we're talking sort of 73 centimetres big.
Yep.
That's a big hit
That's one of the stars. But
lovely.
As well as Constable, there's a Gainsborough drawing, there's a Lucian Freud drawing, there are two Graham Sutherland paintings, there's a Ben Nicholson print. There are two Paul Nash.
Oh, another artist who I adore.
Yes. So it's almost like a history of English watercolour painting from the 18th century through to just about the present day.
I mean, that's the beauty of taking something thematic like trees and seeing it evolve across time. Each of the artists is obviously using them in slightly different ways. But, I mean, is there a defining moment, do you think, where in this book it all comes together? Because I know your final chapter's on Ruskin, isn't it? And what's the role that Ruskin plays in all of this?
Well, I was going to say the defining moment is the 1820s when Palmer and Constable are painting and drawing trees, but also when there's this amazing book called Silver Britannica by Jacob George Strutt, which is a large, I don't know if you know, it's a large folio-sized book with these etched portraits of trees. And anyway, so that's the 1820s. Okay, well, I wanted to do a chapter on Ruskin and the Pre-Raphaelites, because I love the Pre-Raphaelite paintings of trees, such as this one, which is by George Price Boyce. And this is the other star, I think, of the Higgins exhibition. Although, I don't know, the Paul Nashes and the John Nash. Well, yeah, anyway.
You're spoiled, that's the problem.
the good thing about the Bedford exhibition is there's something for everybody, really. But, but this is a wonderful example, I think, of the Pre-Raphaelite approach to landscape. Every single leaf properly painted. I like it too because it's Oxford, it's Binsey.
Yeah, we should give the title. So this one's called At Binsey Near Oxford, and it's 1862, watercolour and ink. Slightly smaller, 31 by
53. So it's a good size for watercolour.
Nice size for a watercolour.
And it's like the Palmer in one sense, because you've got these beautiful trees, and when I looked at it carefully, I realised the tree on the right here is an apple tree.
You can actually see the apples.
And you can see she is resting against the trunk of a tree. There's a woman
little
with a
baby,
child.
Yes.
So you've got that sense of trees enclosing human life and human life benefiting from relationship with trees.
But even these, what are these? These aren't
guinea fowl.
Oh, they're guinea fowl. So the guinea fowl, and then the dove caught up
there.
Yes,
and there are little trees in the little birds.
Robin. You can even make that out as a robin redbreast. It's got a redbreast. So the detail is extraordinary. But again, I think the reason I like it is because it's glimpsed through. You know, it's not this monumental use of trees where, yeah, I suppose if we think of a cloud or something where you've got classical architecture and then possibly
a frame of tree.
But this is, the trees are the main feature, and you're having to get through the trees to see the house and the people and the animals.
Yes.
They're the fabric, aren't they?
Yeah.
And the individual leaves are absolutely extraordinary. And then is this an ivy that's sort of wrapping around the trunk as well, do you think? Because there seems to be all sorts of different types of foliage.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And your eyes are drawn to different things. So over there, there's sort of a water pail where I think a crow is drinking from it or something.
Well, one of the things I suggest for children is to see if they can count the birds in the painting, because there are so many of them.
There are.
But it's really filled with sunlight. I wanted to write about Ruskin partly because I've always had a thing about Ruskin being rude about Constable, because he's really horrible about Constable. He says Constable can't draw. And yet Ruskin loves trees, and he goes on and on about how wonderful trees are. So why couldn't he see how marvellous Constable was as a painter and draftsman of trees? I still don't really understand it.
Do you think it's because he didn't ever see the sketches? Do you think it's because he was looking at his finished
paintings?
He could
have done. Charles Robert Leslie, who was Constable's biographer, was a friend of the family. Mm. They knew each other. But Leslie brought out his Life of Constable, and in the same year, Ruskin published the first volume of Modern Painters, in which he said Turner was the greatest.
Ooh.
And I think ever after that, then they had little spats after that. And you know, Ruskin, and so when Ruskin writes about trees, he goes on about how Turner is brilliant at drawing trees. And yeah, Turner's brilliant at everything, but he's really not that interested in trees.
No, he's not. It's not his priority,
no,
is it?
No.
Unlike Constable, who is almost obsessive about trees.
So Ruskin, I think, is fascinating because he's so inconsistent and annoying and so brilliant. And when it comes to the Pre-Raphaelites and their paintings of trees, he's really ambivalent about them because he doesn't really approve. He's already said that you shouldn't paint each leaf of a tree. He agrees with the drawing manuals on that, and so he can't really approve of what they do. And
of course he can't, because of the hyperrealism in the tradition.
And also he says that it's the pure natural volition of the creation that we want. We don't want trees that are pollarded.
And yet, I mean, if we think about the Millet portrait in the Ashmolean, where every single leaf of the moss is painted in, and that's his way he wants to be remembered art.
Yeah.
So he is completely contradicting
himself.
But
there is a basic contradiction in Ruskin anyway, isn't there?
Yes.
You know, he loves Turner, but then he loves the Pre-Raphaelites.
Yes.
And they're so different. And nobody else believed that they were doing the same thing.
No. He sort of pulled them together, I suppose, through their understanding of the natural world. And
well, he tries to justify it. Yeah, but and pollarded willows. Well, Constable loved pollarded willows, and you see them all the time in the English countryside.
Yeah,
and Millet's Ophelia, pollarded willow.
Exactly.
Hunt's Harling Shepherd, pollarded willows. You know, so there is this.
And yet, so again, remind me of his words are. He just doesn't feel they should be appearing because it's the restriction of nature, the conditioning of nature.
Yeah. So he was into wilderness, really wild nature. Not cicatrized to the pollard, he said.
Right. I think that's really interesting. And again, I see it as a sort of a... Again, there's this tension, isn't there, if you go back to the 18th century, between the sort of very formal garden layouts and then bringing in Capability Brown and Cope and
making it look more natural
and not containing nature. I think Ruskin is almost another regenerative version of that. But it doesn't... to me, it doesn't seem to come down to the level of actually making those spaces. Am I wrong there? Or did they encourage that in garden design as well?
In the 18th century?
Going in through Ruskin onwards. Yeah.
By the 19th century.
Yeah. Because you just don't see that.
Then you get a revival of the formal garden, don't you?
Exactly.
Towards the end of the 19th century.
There's always this tension
between the two.
Yeah.
And a garden is never completely natural.
No.
And also, Ruskin. Well, now I'm getting interested in American landscape painting. And of course, what's interesting about Ruskin is he had the chance to go to America and see proper wilderness, but he never did. And I suppose I got into Ruskin too through working on John Brett. So he's encouraging John Brett to paint Switzerland. And then when John Brett does a wonderful painting of Switzerland, then Ruskin praises it. But he also says it's Mirra's work, it's not man's. You know, it's too realistic.
Ooh. Mm. And that's, I think that there's something very fascinating in the Ashmolean as well, with their permanent collection, where they have the Pre-Raphaelites exhibited. And you have the Ruskin, then you have the Inchbold. And then there's these wonderful sublime landscapes, aren't there, either side, that again, to me, always strike me through their colour, but they have the impression, as you say, of the mirror, that they can't possibly be real. Mm. And yet, in accordance with Ruskin, as you get into the foreground, it's tiny little mosses, it's tiny little rock flowers, all done with that sort of single hair brush. So it's almost like they're trying to appease Ruskin in that respect as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do the big sweeping landscape and then the tiny detail as well. Mm. So when you were going through them, did you have a sort of a favourite tree that keeps appearing and that you enjoy studying?
Well, I think from my childhood, yes, because when I was growing up, I had a favourite tree, which was, guess what, a horse chestnut.
Oh!
And I had a swing attached to a horse chestnut.
Oh, lovely.
But also some beech trees with their roots all intertwining. I knew as a child. So I think those remain my favourite trees. The horse chestnuts look rather straggly at this time of year when they're losing their leaves, but I do think they're the best tree ever in May when they're
Absolutely.
Coming into flower. And then beeches. Look at these beeches now.
We've got some beautiful beaches. Yes, so we're in October.
Beautiful trunks.
And the colour, I mean, that's the other thing, I think, that even on the same page of your book, here we've got the Brett, the hedger, and the opportunity with trees to see the spectrum of colour that comes through, particularly in the autumn. Yep. That's an artist's gift, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
Why would they not want to paint trees?
Yes.
And then when you layer it up with Christian symbolism as well, if you look at the sort of canon of Western art and how trees play a role in that, I think this book needed to be written, didn't it? So we must sort of give everyone the title again. The book is called Silent Witnesses, Trees in British Art, 1760 to 1870 by Christiana Payne. And the exhibition is A Walk in the Woods, a celebration of trees in British art. And it's running from the 30th of September until the 25th of February next year. And that is at the Higgins in Bedford. It is such a pleasure to talk with you. Oh, we had a reason for this, which was the anniversary, which we haven't talked
about. The tree
charter. Here we go. This was the other reason that we wanted to get this out ASAP. So it is the 800th anniversary of the tree charter, isn't it? Just tell the listeners a little bit more.
So the Charter of the Forest came 2 years after Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. So it was produced in 1217, isn't it? On the 6th of November. And there are two copies of the tree charter still in existence. One is in Durham Cathedral and the other is in Lincoln Cathedral. So the Woodland Trust decided to issue a new tree charter, which is being launched on Monday, November the 6th, exactly 800 years later. And we're going to go to Lincoln Cathedral, and it's going to be written in oak gall ink. And it has 10 principles, one of which is recognising the cultural importance of trees and forests. So that's where I come in. But actually, I agree with most of it, really. It's all about trees and well-being, having more trees in our cities, allowing more access to the woodlands and so on. And I was very happy when I realised my book was going to come out in this wonderful year when there's so much interest in trees. And I think trees are really important.
We need
to look after them.
And so the original charter in 1217, what was that actually trying to do? Defend the rights of the forest, the people who were
The rights of free men in the forest. Mm. So to take wood for fuel, And to pasture their animals and that sort of thing.
Mm, because so much of it was in royal hands, wasn't it?
Yes, a third of the land area of England. Of course, forest in those days meant more than what we think of as forest now. Yeah. It could mean wood pasture as well.
OK. So that was an important document at the time, you know, to be thinking about how Magna Carta is so closely related to the tree, to the Forest Charter. I think
yes.
that's profound,
oh, yes.
isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
The
yes.
rights of man and the rights of trees.
Exactly.
So it's going to be very exciting on next week then, when you go to listen to it in Lincoln. And the whole chart, the new charter we read out, is that right?
Yes.
And
yes.
then someone will actually sit and scribe it all out in Oak Gall.
Well, it's already been written in Oak Gall ink. But Fiona Stafford, who has written... Well, I think the principles were established through the Woodland Trust collecting 60,000 tree stories by people saying why trees were important to them. Huh. And... then she has sort of expanded on the points. So she's written some of the text and she's going to be reading out the whole thing.
Oh, it's going to be wonderful. And how perfect that you can have this exhibition, this book,
yeah.
all in the 800th anniversary year of the Tree Charter. Amazing. Well, I'm so glad we had a chance to talk. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to the Art Detective listeners.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.